Hey, hey, Los Angeles. I am coming to do a live event in Santa Monica on April 24th in the evening. I'm so excited to get to hang out with you again. If you want to get your tickets, they are priced to sell out. You can go to markgroves.com/Los Angeles and go get them now. And I can't wait to see you there. We're going to hang out for an evening of intimate conversation, live coaching, all that jazz. Looking forward to it. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Mark Groves podcast. There has been a deep, deep personal exploration for me in the space of metabolic health, cardiovascular health, glucose, which are all overlapping words and subjects. And the only reason I really know that is because of today's guest. I have had the honor of when I was kind of like, I got a blood results. I got like a panel done. And I was freaking out when I got it. And I'm honored to have had him on the podcast before. So I reached out to him and I was like, hey, man, I'm freaking out. I think I'm going to die from a heart attack next week. Like, what should I do? And he was so generous with the level of information that he shared. And I've since been a member of his community, consumed lots of his content because surprisingly, he doesn't want to answer all my questions all the time because he's created so much epic content on it. So I'm really excited to have Ben Azadi back on the podcast to talk about metabolic freedom.
Oh, Mark, I am excited to be with you, brother. I love you. I love what you're doing. Let's rock round two, man. We're going to have some fun.
Yeah, for me, you know, the birth of my work really in the space of relationship, which is not separate from the relationship that we have to our own physiology, to our bodies, and all the ways in which we can cause inflammation in our bodies. And as you know, coming from a background of being in pharma for 14 years, it was like every time I, you know, much like when you and I hopped on a call to talk about that blood panel, again, the things that I'm told in by a standard GP, not that there aren't amazing ones, is just not informed. And it was so much more layered when you went through the whole picture of what was going on in my body that I got to exhale. And you're like, buddy, like you can do something about this. Are you kidding? And for you guys, my A1C would be traditionally, like traditional medicine would be in the high normal, not pre-diabetic, but like right on the edge. But in functional medicine, that would have been considered, hey, you're on the way to insulin resistance, which for me was the necessary wake-up call that I needed rather than waiting to 5'7 or 5'8 where it would have been. So I'm curious for you, Ben, am I a pretty standard case, you know, when it comes to this like positive intent of wanting to maintain health, but really being told, okay, we're going to have to put you on metformin. We're going to like, what is it? There's clearly a lot of pharma solutions to this, but there's clearly a large problem. And I think the pun being intended there, that we have a lot of obesity. We have a lot of metabolic dysfunction. We now have so much dementia and we're calling that type 3 diabetes. So what are the problems that we're all facing today?
Yeah, and you're not uncommon. Everybody's trying to do their best with their current ability of awareness and their resources. And we just have so much information. And I think that's the problem. It's a lot of misinformation. We're drowning in information, starving for that true wisdom, the truth, what's going to work for me. What does make you different is that you did more labs than the average person. The average person just gets their annual report and you did a lot more than that. And you actually made the necessary lifestyle changes to you know, change that, right? Which is fantastic. But yeah, the average person, you know, they get their lab report and their standard reference range is not, it's looking at disease. It's looking to diagnose disease. It's not looking to see if you're functioning at the optimal level. So there's the standard reference range. There's a functional reference range. Their standard reference range on these lab reports are factoring in the millions, tens and hundreds of millions who have done these labs. And we live in a country, not just in the US, but Canada and around the world, that have a lot of people that are unhealthy. We don't want to be the average of unhealthy people. We want to be functioning at our best, right? So the reference ranges are very different between the standard and the functional ranges. And when we think about the state of our health or lack thereof in the United States, we spend $4.6 trillion every year on healthcare in the United States, which would be the fourth largest GDP in the world if it was a GDP. And one out of every $4 is spent on diabetes, primarily type 2 diabetes, which is a lifestyle condition treated with medication. Huge mismatch. You mentioned obesity. In the 1930s, obesity in the U.S. was around 1% to 2%, very, very small. Now Harvard is saying by 2030, it's going to be 50%. That's our nuts. Genetics don't change that fast, so it's not our genes. It's not a genetic issue. It's an epigenetic issue. It's an environmental, a lifestyle issue. So with the amount of information there, we have people promoting carnivore, keto, veganism, go on statins, don't use statins. It just confuses people. It creates this syndrome where it's like, I don't know what to do. I'm paralyzed. Let me just listen to this doctor because he's in a white coat and I'll take the drug. But the drugs are just masking the symptoms. Symptoms are a gift. If you have brain fog, if you're overweight, if you have high blood pressure, if you have autoimmune disease, these are all symptoms. They're not the problem. They're actually a result of the problem. They are opportunities to learn why you have these symptoms. They're your body's check engine light. They're actually a gift, not a problem. But conventional medicine looks at them as a problem. And it's the old whack-a-mole game. And I talk about this in the book, Metabolic Freedom. When we take a medication or do a surgery that masks the symptom, it's like a mole that pops up at the arcade and you hit it with a hammer and then another mole pops up, another symptom, because these medications have side effects. They're not getting to the cause. Mm-hmm. What we want to do is change our lifestyle, get to the cause, find out what the cause is, remove that interference. Then the body heals itself. God built the body to be self-healing. It goes to heal itself. It has this inner physician. So you are different in that aspect, that you understand that and you follow the necessary steps. You have progressed so much. You've gotten your A1C down. You're going to retest. We're going to look at that. But I think it's just, I feel bad for people because it's just so much information. And how do you know, who do you know? Like, how do you know to trust? You should trust somebody? You have so many authority figures. You have social media has made this polarizing. And I think a good solution would be, you know, find somebody that you've been following. Maybe it's a podcast or YouTube, maybe somebody you're working with. And if you really like vibe with them, you feel like they're a good person, you love their personality, then go all in with them. You know, give them 3 months, 6 months, go with their protocols. Hopefully it's lifestyle stuff, not medication stuff. And see what it does for you. And then just ignore all the other advice. As I know that's difficult to do, probably, but just ignore all the other advice and just hone in on one or two people and just go all in with your information and see what it does for you.
Well, I think when we take that approach, you're right. The social media will overwhelm us with so much information, not to mention even going to the doctor's office. And I think one of the greatest misconceptions when I hear someone talk about their A1C or their glucose, and they're not in the world that you're in and that I'm blessed to now be in, which is you can do something about it. Like when I had that, I would say it was a wake up call in a lot of ways, because I was still fit. I was still running. I was still working out. But I wasn't dialed. And that was clear from my blood chemistry. It was showing up. It was showing up in abdominal adiposity, like fat around my midsection. And I didn't get to dad bod, but I wasn't far from dad bod. And when I heard you can do something about it, it's amazing what it did for me, because I then put in the dietary things that we'll talk about. What I loved about your approach is, which I know you cover in your book too, is you were like, okay, this is high. Like, you need to do some high intensity interval training, like some sprints, and that will actually help with that. And my testosterone was like low normal. It was normal in the 400s. That would be considered like low normal, right?
Yep.
And then when we retested, it was like 1,050. It was insane. And I didn't take anything.
Yeah.
Which is crazy. I just made a dietary change. I lost weight from the result of the dietary change. And so when I hear someone get a result and then they're kind of sad and sort of hopeless and have, they feel like disappointed about their own body, that their body let them down. But like traditional diet information is really, and I remember hearing this when I was in my teens and 20s as an athlete, it was like, if you want to lose weight, calories in, calories out. So I'm curious, you talk about that as a failed approach to fat loss. So maybe we can go into more detail.
Yeah, that's the old way of thinking, that, you know, it's an energy issue. If you consume too much energy, then you burn, you're going to store that energy. And it kind of makes sense, but the body's way more sophisticated than a math equation or a bank account. We're a very complex chemistry lab. And, you know, for many years, Mark, I used to teach the old calories in versus calories out approach. I used to own a gym here in Miami, a CrossFit gym, and I used to back in 2013, 2014, host these seminars. I called it the Science of Fat Loss. And I would teach my community how to calculate their total energy expenditure, get into a deficit. You know, and it's thought that if you create a 3,500 calorie deficit, that's 1 pound of fat. You keep doing that.
I remember that exact number. Yeah,
exactly. And it kind of makes sense. And it kind of fools people because it works in the beginning. And what ends up happening is your metabolism starts to adapt and slow down to match the energy coming in. So you could only cut so much. You could continue cutting and exercising and cutting and exercising. And then you're relying on willpower. You're depriving yourself. It's just not a fun way to live. And all of a sudden you've wrecked your metabolism. And what I've learned is that the metabolism doesn't even necessarily work in speeds. It works in efficiency or inefficiency. And my major premise, as I mentioned earlier, is that the body is built to heal itself. So when I started to learn this and believe in this incredible innate intelligence within the body, I started to understand that, yeah, calories matter, but they're not important. They're not very important at all. It's really about hormones and inflammation. If you take care of that, then the weight loss comes off as a side effect, meaning the people that are focused on calories in versus calories out, they're still out there and they come after me all the time. Their philosophy is that we need to lose weight in order to get healthy. Mm-hmm. But I make the case in the book that we don't lose weight to get healthy. We get healthy to lose weight. Very different.
I like that.
And when you get healthy, the weight stays off. The weight comes off as a side effect, right? So if we could give somebody 800 calories and cut their calories and that comes from processed carbohydrates. And we could give somebody else 800 calories, which is still cutting their calories, but it's from, let's say, steak. Completely different physiological responses here, right? The person with the steak is going to feel so much better and lower inflammation, not feel hungry because they're not spiking glucose. So it's really not about calories. Calories are a distraction. Once you start eating real food, eating meat, eating fat and protein, you're just going to live your life and naturally fast and skip meals and not have to snack and rely on food. And the weight will start to come off because you're lowering inflammation, which allows your hormones to balance out. So it's about hormones and inflammation, not about calories.
Wow. So I like the way you've reframed that it's like you don't lose weight to pursue health. You get healthy and weight as a natural byproduct falls away. This is true of too, like psychological health. You know, like you really, when you start to do that inner work, the toxic people fall away. Everything starts to fall away because they're no longer a match for what you're doing. You can't keep them in your ecosystem. That's why the process of healing emotionally requires nutritional healing. It does, because you can't put only nutritious people in your life and then eat shit. It just doesn't work, you know? And I think the powerful thing about understanding and changing dietary things is that you feel the result immediately. Like when you start to adjust emotionally and put boundaries in your life, the immediate result is not amazing. It's like fear, uncertainty. But when you actually start to eat the way that you're proposing, you immediately feel better. It's like exercise has a direct feedback loop too. Maybe when you're running that first kilometer or first mile you've ever run, it's hard. But when you're done, you're not like, that was the worst thing. When you're done, you're proud of yourself and your body rewards you with the neural cocktail and the way you feel. So as a way to look at this, you know, metabolic challenge, what would you call it? Like metabolic dysfunction? Is that the right term?
That's a good term. Yeah. Metabolic challenge, metabolic dysfunction. Yep.
What do you propose is like because you've now worked with hundreds, thousands of people. What is it that you see time and time again is the way that we begin to resolve this?
Yeah, the first thing is to remove the interference. And in the book, I go over the top main causes of metabolic dysfunction and disease. And the first one, I believe, is high levels of insulin, the hormone insulin. You know, insulin is not a bad hormone. God didn't make any bad hormones. Everything in our body is amazing. But when we are constantly spiking insulin through high carbohydrate foods and snacking, insulin is kind of a bully of a hormone. Your fat burning hormones and your fat storage hormone, insulin, they can't coexist. Your fat storage hormones go into hiding. So when we start to elevate our insulin levels, this is a growth factor. Things start to grow, and cancer could grow, by the way. And you will have high levels of insulin way before your blood sugars even change, which is really fascinating. Mark, you're going to love this factoid. And I put some studies in the book referencing this, but the studies are showing that on average, you could have insulin resistance, high levels of insulin, for about 6 to 14 years before your fasting blood sugar or A1C changes at all. because your pancreas is just so busy just shouting out, producing insulin, that it's clearing the glucose until all of a sudden it goes deaf to the screams. Then the blood sugars dramatically shift and you're diagnosed with prediabetes or diabetes. So getting a fasting insulin blood test is one of the most important tests you can do for your metabolism. You want to see that fasting insulin in the single digits. Anything under 10 is great. 3 to 7 is optimal. If we see that 12, 15, 17, 22, that's insulin resistance, and your blood sugars might look perfect even with those levels of insulin. So I would make sure I monitor the insulin levels. I want to get that in the single digits. And when you do that, everything will improve. You'll start to feel better. You'll start to burn fat. You'll get better sleep, less inflammation. So it starts with insulin, because when insulin is high, it's the first domino that triggers high blood pressure, high blood sugars, eventually prediabetes, type 2 diabetes, which then opens up the door for cancer, heart disease, and autoimmune disease. But it starts with high levels of insulin.
Wow. And people don't even understand that. Like, that's not a conversation that we generally have. It's cholesterol first, yeah. Almost always.
That's right.
You know how much I love understanding the deeper layers of life, relationships, emotions, and yeah, especially our health. And one of the biggest game changers for me has been learning how my body actually responds to everything I do in terms of what I eat, how I sleep, and how I handle stress. And NutriSense has really made this so possible for me. This is a brand that I sought out to work with because I love what they did and what they stood for. And to give you some context, right now, only about 12% of Americans are metabolically healthy, and a third are pre-diabetic, most without even knowing it. And the way we've been taught to think about health is outdated. It's not about quick fixes or guessing games. It's about real-time insights and personalized guidance that can create long-term sustainable change. For me, I got a blood glucose, an A1C measurement that came back where I was high normal. And I was like, nope, type 2 diabetes is in my family, never happening to me. So this is why I started working with NutriSense, where they combine continuous glucose monitoring with expert one-on-one nutritionist support. So you're not just tracking numbers, you're understanding what they mean and how to optimize your health. So it's not about restriction or following rigid rules, it's about discovering what actually works for your body. So maybe that smoothie you thought was healthy is actually spiking your blood sugar. Or maybe pairing carbs with protein could change everything for your energy levels. These are the kinds of real eye-opening insights NutriSense provides. One of the most surprising things I learned was I was so hypersensitive to sweet potatoes. They made my blood glucose skyrocket. But then I learned that if I changed the order of how I ate my food, my proteins and my veggies, and then that, it mitigated that. So what I love most about this is that you're not left to figure it out alone. Your personal nutritionist helps interpret the data and suggest simple, actionable tweaks that can actually make a difference. So if you're ready to take control of your health in a way that's personalized, backed by science, and actually sustainable, check out NutriSense. Head over to www.nutrisense.io/marketing/Mark Groves and use the code Mark Groves to get $125 off. Your body is already communicating with you. NutriSense just helps you understand what it's saying.
You know, I like the way Dr. Ken Berry, my friend, put it. He said, when you're just looking at total cholesterol as it pertains to heart disease and you're missing A1C and insulin, total cholesterol is like a BB gun pointed at your knee. Fasting insulin is like a shotgun to your heart, right? That's way more important, more important to test for, but the average test does not include a fasting insulin. And sometimes conventional doctors don't even order it for you. But the good news is this, it's a very cheap test. So even if your insurance does not cover it, it's cheap. It's like $30. And there's also some companies that will ship a kit to you and you could do a finger prick to get your fasting insulin. That would be the baseline, the starting point for you to know what your levels are.
So once we work with insulin and we begin, you know, although you're saying the high carbohydrate diets, that's what creates that processed foods. So where do we begin to lower our insulin? And then where do we go from there?
Yeah, this leads us to, of course, the foods we eat, the three macronutrients. We have carbohydrates, we have protein, we have fat. Out of those three macronutrients, carbohydrates by far spike blood insulin levels more than protein and fat. And in the book, I show this graph of the blood insulin from carbohydrates, protein, and fat. Of course, processed carbs will spike it higher than whole foods carbs, but protein has a very moderate, what's considered a phase 2 insulin response. There is an increase in insulin, but it's not that much. And fat barely moves insulin. So it makes sense to, okay, eat less carbs and eat more protein and fat. Like that would be the starting point to lower your insulin levels. The second piece, which is you do at the same time, is to eliminate snacking. Snacking is going to spike your insulin levels. And the average American, this is crazy, but the average American eats around 17 to 23 times per day in the form of grazing and snacking. And yeah, they have their meals, but they're grazing throughout the day. It's constant glucose and insulin spike. So the first step, lower carbs, increase protein and fat, and eliminate the snacking. Just have your three meals a day, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. That's a good starting point.
Yeah, when you told me that, I remember thinking, I do spend a lot of my day snacking. And when you told me that, to like allow my blood sugar to come back down again and then, you know, eat. And to keep, what is the ideal glucose range that you're looking for? And what do you recommend as a way of even beginning to monitor the glucose?
Yeah, I mean, you're wearing a CGM, a continuous glucose monitor. Mm-hmm. That's a great, great tool. There's also finger prick devices like a Keto Mojo and others out there.
Those are great.
Canada, I believe, has the Flora 6, it's called. It's very similar. So you prick your finger, you put the strip, you put the blood on the strip, put the strip in the meter, and it gives you your blood sugar. The CGM, of course, you wear it usually behind your tricep for 14 days. There you go. Mark's wearing it right there, and it gives you continuous reading. That is better, because it gives you 24/7 of your glucose. But the optimal range is going to be 70 to 90 milligrams per deciliter when you're in a fasted state, which is one teaspoon of sugar in the entire bloodstream. That's considered an optimal state. So 70 to 90. And after eating, you just don't want it to go over 120 milligrams per deciliter. And you also want to see your glucose levels go back to where it was before you started eating 2 hours after eating, meaning if you tested your blood sugar with either a CGM or a finger prick, and let's say it's 85, you're fasted, maybe it's in the morning, you eat a meal, you test 2 hours later, it should be close to 85 2 hours later. That shows your metabolism is functioning optimally. You produced the right amount of insulin and it took you right back to baseline. But if you see it elevated 2 hours later, over 100, 120, that shows that you have insulin resistance. Your metabolism is just not clearing that glucose the way we want it to.
Yeah. So when you're wearing the CGM, which I find so educational, right? Like all of a sudden now these foods, the order I eat the foods, I had no idea that like sweet potatoes would rock me to like 150, 160. I just seem to be hypersensitive to specific, like that more specifically than anything. I was telling you before we hit record too, that the other day I was at a coffee shop. I was like, I should have just got a black coffee, like, duh. But I was thinking I won't get almond milk. I'll get regular dairy. I couldn't believe it moved me from like 90 to 130 something,
yeah.
Which I don't normally drink regular milk unless it's raw. But I just don't really drink it very often. I usually drink like a basically one carbohydrate in an almond milk. But I know you also have thoughts on almonds.
I do. Yeah. Well, back to the, I'll talk about almonds in a second, if you would have had half and half or heavy cream, I don't think you would have seen the spike. I would be curious to see that if you tested that.
Test that next time. I'll be like, do you have just regular cream?
Yeah. Heavy cream.
Also, because it tastes so good.
I know. It's great. That's what I use. I use heavy cream in my coffee and there's usually not a spike. It might be the lactose and the whole milk that spikes, but that's still uncommon to see it rise. But everybody's different. That's the value of a continuous glucose monitor. We're all so different. But yeah, I don't like almond milk. I don't like almonds in general. There's a few reasons, but the main reason is because it contains an anti-nutrient called oxalates. And oxalates for a lot of people are a big issue. Oxalates, oxalic acid, it's these tiny little crystals that you cannot see, obviously, looking at the almonds or almond milk, but through a microscope, you can see them. They look like little needles. And it could poke holes in your gut and your intestinal lining, leading to gut irritation and inflammation, and potentially also triggering autoimmune disease, leading to kidney stones. And it's just not a good idea to have a lot of oxalates in your diet. Now, some people could get away with it. They're very healthy. They're not oxalate sensitive, but there are a lot of people out there who feel awful and they don't know why. And it's because they're consuming a lot of almonds and almond milk. And it's not just the almonds and almond milk. It's the spinach. Spinach is loaded with oxalates.
Yeah.
Spinach smoothies. That's like one of the worst things you can do. It's just getting a dump of oxalates. So I'm not a fan of almonds. Instead, I use, you know, macadamia nut.
Sure, yummy.
Yeah, which is amazing.
Milk is so good.
So good. Or pecans. There's something called peely nuts, which is great. It's a really high fat, low carb nut. I tend to stay away from almonds.
Okay, so let's say we're listening to this. We're like, okay, I want to get my glucose under control. And I do, for you listening or watching, this isn't just when your glucose is good. This is good to do all the time so that you have awareness about how different foods impact you and also how eating in a different order can also impact that. Can you share a bit about why that is? Like if I eat the steak before the potato?
Yeah. It's a cool little tip. And I do talk about this in the book as a biohack. There is a lot of science showing that meal pairing, meaning when the order in which you have your macronutrients makes a big difference on that postprandial glucose, the blood sugar spike after eating. When you have protein first before the carbohydrates, it buffers that glucose response and it slows down digestion and it just allows your body to metabolize that glucose more efficiently. And numerous studies show this. You could reverse that and have carbs then protein and you won't get the same effect. So if you do have a mixed meal, you want to start with protein, vegetables, fiber, and you want to have the carbohydrates last. Now, if you do end up having carbs first, or you just have a whole bunch of carbs and you're like, oh my gosh, what did I just do? Going for a walk right after that high carb meal makes a huge difference. You could blunt that postprandial glucose response by 30 to 40% by going for a 20-minute walk. It's just in general a good idea to go for a walk after your meals. It's one of the best fat loss tips I've implemented with my clients. So walking after a meal is a great fat loss strategy.
So if for the people who are like, okay, I really want to, maybe my glucose is on the way up, I'm learning about this, I want to reverse type 2 diabetes, or I just want to optimize my insulin. And I know you're a big proponent of the ketogenic diet, which is what I took on, but like a version of it, which I really like. And the reason you promote that type of eating is to create metabolic flexibility in the way you have implemented it and taught people. So what does it mean to be ketogenic? How do you begin to do that? What's the impact on insulin?
Yeah, and ketogenic, it's an incredible process. And I'm very non-dogmatic, as you know, Mark, about keto. I look at it as a tool, but not the only tool. And let me share some stats, and then it'll link keto to why keto is so important these days. In 2016, the Mayo Clinic put out a study. They were looking at the United States population, thousands of people, and they wanted to determine, okay, how many Americans live what they consider an active, healthy lifestyle. And they based it off of four criteria. The first criteria was that they don't smoke cigarettes. Second criteria was that they got moderate to vigorous exercise activity for a total of 150 minutes total per week. The third criteria was that if they're a male, they had a body fat percentage under 20%, female under 30%. And the fourth criteria was that they ate a healthy diet, which was classified as a low processed diet. And the study concluded that only 2.7% of Americans were what they considered active and healthy. 2.7%. That's it.
That's no one.
That's it. It's like, yeah, me and a few other people, maybe you. Yeah. I think you hit those markers, right?
I think I do. Yeah.
Yeah. Pretty sure you do now. And then in 2018, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill showed a study with over 8,000 Americans in the study. It concluded that 88% of Americans are metabolically unhealthy. And then that was followed up by another study in 2022 showing it's closer to 93% of Americans being metabolically unhealthy. This is crazy. This is a very, very high percentage.
That's almost everybody.
That's almost everyone.
Yeah, guess what we have for everyone? Here's some Ozempic and some Metformin some statins.
That's the easy solution. Yeah. Exactly. Like that's the magic pill, but that's not the solution. So the point being, is that in the book, I make the case that these people are in a keto deficiency. They forgot how to burn fat. They're sugar burners. They're stuck burning sugar. They really need this metabolic process called ketosis. And that's what keto is. It's technically not a diet. It's a metabolic process. Ketones are simply a byproduct of burning your own body fat. And we're naturally designed to burn our own body fat. When we have metabolic dysfunction, like 93% of people, they're not doing that. They're burning sugar from food and that's it. So we want to get them in ketosis to teach their metabolism to burn stored fat. And the amazing thing is that you can do that within 7 to 14 days. I have a protocol in the book on showing you how to do that. So you want to shift into burning fat instead of sugar. You want to stay there for a little bit, then you flex out. You don't stay there forever. The goal is metabolic flexibility. You go in and out of ketosis. So I love ketosis. It's incredible for the brain, for the mitochondria, especially if you have high levels of insulin and high levels of blood sugar. It's one of the most powerful things you can do to lower that really dramatically. I use it a lot for type 2 diabetics, PCOS individuals, insulin resistance. So I think keto is phenomenal, and we just forgot how to burn fat. And I want to educate people and remind them that you're designed to burn fat. Here's how you do it.
So when you're beginning on that journey of ketosis, you're in your protocol in this book, is it different than former teachings? Or what does it entail?
The first week is very similar in order to go from burning sugar to burning fat. There's a 30-day plan in the book. The remaining 3 weeks are very different. It's brand new, and it's designed to create what I call metabolic confusion. We know from like great personal trainers and fitness coaches and that program, P90X. Do you remember P90X?
Dude, Tony Horton, that guy was bumping out 30 wide grip chin-ups like it owed them money. Crazy.
Beast, right?
Beast.
That program, and I did it during my initial weight loss. It actually helped kickstart my
weight loss. I love P90X, man.
Extreme. Yeah. That's right. And then Insanity and all the other Beachbody ones.
Yeah.
But the reason why I was so successful and it worked is because it created what they call muscle confusion. Every workout was different, high rep, low weight, low rep, and then different weights, different movements, and it creates this confusion. The body doesn't adapt. You continue to get results. So the same thing, the same philosophy I applied to the book in this 30-day plan, where every week there's a different protocol where you're creating metabolic confusion so you're not plateauing and not stalling. So the first week is very similar to like what I have in Keto Flex and what you've seen in the Keto Camp Academy in terms of burning fat, burning sugar to burning fat. Then the remaining weeks are very different because it's strategized to create this metabolic confusion.
So you would start with the reducing in that first week, you'd be reducing your carbohydrate intake. And then what creates the confusion? Like what do you do in the second, third, fourth week? Like what's kind of like a top overview of that?
Yeah. So the first week you gradually lower carbs, gradually increase protein and fat, eliminate snacking and shift efficiently into burning fat without any symptoms. The remaining weeks are designed to create different fasting schedules, 14 hours some days, 18 hours some days, 24 hours as you get ready for that. So the fasting schedule changes, and then we manipulate the protein intake. Some days are lower protein, some moderate, some high. And then as the weeks go on, we focus more on high protein. So we manipulate the macronutrients a little bit. And then we change the fasting schedule to have some feast days, what I call flex days, which I know you do on Sundays, where you're actually intentionally getting out of ketosis and burning sugar for a day. So there's a couple of flex days in there as well.
If you're ready to invest in and level up your health and well-being, listen up. The Institute of Integrative Nutrition is the world's most respected nutrition and health coaching school, with the largest global presence in health coaching. Their online health coach training program and additional courses provide their students and graduates with the tools and knowledge they need to transform their own personal health, as well as the health of their clients and communities around the world. Not only am I a faculty member of the Health Coach Training Program, teaching on the subject of relationships and shadow work, but I personally know numerous people who've taken IIN's program and have become some of the best health coaches I know. What makes IIN different is that their courses offer a holistic approach to health that considers all aspects of an individual, from your physical health, nutrition, and environment, to your mental, emotional, and spiritual well-being. When you enroll in their courses, you'll learn the tools and techniques that allow you to embrace coaching as a lifestyle. You are your client first, and create the foundation for personal and professional transformation. What's really exciting is that IIN recently partnered with Chopra Global, the company founded in Deepak Chopra's vision, which means all Chopra courses are now available through IIN, expanding their health, wellness, and coaching course offerings to include meditation, Ayurveda, and yoga, as well as Chopra's coaching certification. If this sounds interesting to you, you can save 20% off site-wide. That's 20% off all the courses from IIN and Chopra when you visit bit.ly/markiin and use the code markgroves20 at checkout. That's bit.ly/markiin and use the code mark20 for 20% off site-wide.
Yeah, because a lot of the pushback or criticism of ketosis is it's not sustainable long-term. And I mean, I've heard my mom actually, ironically, yesterday just texted me. She said to me a couple of weeks ago, they were visiting, and she was like, she's Irish. She was like, "You're not going to be like eating like this forever, are you?" And I was like, "Yeah." And I love it. And she was like, "But you're so, it's restrictive. Like, you know, you're not,
it's not a way to live. And I was like, I love it. Like, I actually feel so good. I eat amazing foods. Are you kidding? I crush 100% chocolate. I love it. I feel so good. And I'm like, Mom, on Sundays, I go into the flex space. I started to realize, like, a lot of the time someone has resistance to what I'm doing is because they don't have access to discipline around their own diet. So because they have, and I'm not, this might not be true of my mom, but this I think is true, is that there's like, I wish I had more choice around my foods. Like, I had the level of discipline that I've now created and proven in myself. I like trust myself to make so many choices in my life because of what I've created in this health space. And she sent me a study yesterday of how ketosis, low carb diets increase colorectal cancer, to which I Googled and then found a study just released on how, or maybe it was last year, on how low carbohydrate diets reduce colorectal cancer. And I said, just pick whatever side you want. So I'm curious, the effects of ketosis long-term, the criticisms, and like she was saying on colorectal cancer.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack there. Your mom is very similar to mine, by the way. She, you know, when I do my carnivore,
put them on a text thread, maybe.
Yeah, right.
Text seriously. Each other.
They're just going to complain about us all day. when I do my carnivore stints, and I have dinner with my mom every Thursday, my mom and my fiance, and I explain to her, yeah, I'm doing carnivore, I only eat meat, and she doesn't like that. She's like, wait, what? How long are you doing this for? Is it over yet? my mom's very similar. I agree with the notion that long-term ketosis is not good for you. I agree with that. That's not something I promote. I like going in and out of ketosis, but a lot of the studies out there, and I imagine if I looked at the study your mom referenced, there's a lot of ways to do keto that's inflammatory. You could do keto with bad inflammatory fats. You could do keto with a lot of artificial ingredients. And yeah, it's keto. It's a keto diet, but it's not necessarily a clean way to do keto. So the way I teach keto, of course, is a clean way. It's a whole food way, devoid of seed oils and artificial sweeteners. There's many different ways to do keto. So when I look at these studies showing it increases cancer risk, and I look at the studies and they're feeding them soybean oil, canola oil, these vegetable oils. So yeah, of course, that's not going to be good for you. But you know, to your mom's point and the people who say long-term ketosis is not good for you, I say, yes, I agree. I don't teach that and I don't recommend that. That's why we have the flex days. That's why, Mark, you're flexing out on Sundays. We're creating a balance here where we're not...
Great day.
Yeah, right? It's an awesome day. I have, you know, personally, I have 300 to 400 grams of carbs on my flex day and I love it.
And then you go below 30 the next day?
And then, yeah, I go to zero because I do carnivore the next day. Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. I might try that because you gave me the advice last time because I was telling you I crushed a bunch of carbs, not necessarily in a way you informed me. And then I just saw my CGM and I was like, oh, good Lord. It like spiked and then it crashed. And I sent you an image of it. I was like, damn, I don't know. I'm skiing apparently. Like, this is quite a slope. And you had told me crush a lot of protein in the meal, reduce fat.
Yes.
And the last time I did it, I stayed at around 100, 97-ish. I think my largest spike was to like 107.
Wow. Even with around 200 grams of carbs?
I probably ate around 120 or 150.
Yeah, great.
And I had rice, probably like half a cup, three quarters of a cup. But because of the order I ate my food, I had a protein shake with psyllium in it before I had, and some creatine, before I had two of the meals just to get my protein high for each meal. And I was like, wow, this is actually pretty impressive. I was kind of happy about it.
Yeah, look at that. That's exactly how you do it. And you made the point that you lowered your fat. That's an important note. A high carb day, what I call a keto flex day, or in the book, a metabolic flex day, it's a low fat day. You know, we don't want to have high carbs and high fat. That is a disaster for the metabolism. And not to go into
the
science.
American diet, isn't it?
Standard American diet, exactly. Yeah. But, you know, not to go too deep into the science, but there is something called the Randall cycle. And essentially what that means is when you are eating a meal, which is high fat and high carb, standard American diet, your metabolism will prioritize metabolizing the sugar first, because sugar is very toxic in the body when it's elevated. So then you have all this fat pooling up in your bloodstream, raising your triglycerides, raising something called lipopolysaccharides, and it's inflammatory. So you want, on a high carb day, It's a lower fat day, under 50, 40 grams of fat total for that day. That's a very important note. And I reference that in the book as well.
Yeah. So for people who are interested in trying this, the what is sort of like, I guess, the simple advice for those keto flex days? Like what kind of carbs would you eat? And yeah, like what would you be seeking to get into your body so you're getting the nutrients from it?
Yeah, it's not a cheat day. All right. We're intentional with saying it's a feast day, not a cheat day. There's a difference. So you want to eat whole food carbohydrates. White rice is something I have a lot on my flex days. So white rice, brown rice for some people could be okay as well. Fruit, potatoes, sweet potatoes, white potatoes. Anything that's a whole food carbohydrates. In the book, I have an entire list of these metabolic flex day foods, but anything that's a carbohydrate from a whole food, meaning it doesn't require an ingredients label because what you see is right in front of you. So it's not pizza. It's not ice cream and donuts. Though. Yeah, I do too. It's delicious. But ideally, you want to have whole foods whole food carbohydrates on that flex day.
Oh, yeah. You'd be getting a lot of fat from the pizza. So you'd be in a high fat, high.
Yep. Yep, yeah, exactly.
God damn it.
And from ice cream.
So not good long-term. You don't recommend that. You do talk a lot about environmental toxins in the book. So do you think the FDA and like other health bodies, which of course is a large area of controversy, especially right now, do you think that they are addressing these issues appropriately and should they be doing something different?
Oh, they're absolutely not addressing it appropriately. Yeah. Yes, they should be doing something differently. I think they are. I pray they are right now.
I hope so. It feels like it-ish.
Yeah, I pray, right? We need a change. We know that. It's probably the biggest reason why we have disease. It's these environmental toxins. I have a whole chapter on them. I make the case in the book, and I give the comparison of Europe, specifically Italy, as it relates to lifespan, obesity, diabetes in Italy versus the U.S., Italy has a longer life expectancy. They live past 80 on average. We're around 77 on average here in the U.S. Italy has a fraction of the diabetes and the obesity rates we have here in the U.S. Yet when we look at Italy, they don't have more gyms than us. They have a fraction of the gyms. Yeah, they walk more. Okay. They're not working out more. So what's the difference? Why are they so much healthier? I'm not saying they're healthy, but they're healthier, way more healthier than us. And it led me to look into what Italy has done different. And they have banned or have really high regulations on toxins, environmental toxins, glyphosate, red dyes. 2016, they outlawed a lot of these, and yet we still have it in our food supply. We're giving it to our children every single day. Glyphosate being a huge one there. Mm-hmm. But it's not just the glyphosate, of course. It's all these plastics, these toxins, right? You know, you see me drinking out of my glass. I think you have like a stainless steel or something.
I have a mug right now.
A mug. Yeah, there you go. A mug. So plastic water bottles and plastic cutting boards and plastic everywhere. It's these microplastics are everywhere. And there's a study from the University of Newcastle, excuse me, that I put in the book that showed the average American consumes a credit card size worth of plastic every single week, about 5 grams of plastic, which equals a credit card every single week.
Can you even metabolize that or process it?
No. Some of it we do. Otherwise,
we'd become a credit card.
Yeah, we become exactly.
Amazon, we're just like shopping.
Yeah, we do metabolize some of it, but a lot of it gets stored in our body. Studies are showing microplastics in men's testicles, which is why we have a big fertility issue here, and low testosterone levels in the United States, showing it in our arteries and it's just not good. So some simple things you can do, drink out of glass instead of plastic. Instead of using a plastic cutting board, use a wooden cutting board. Instead of using plastic Tupperware, use glass Tupperware. Some simple things like that go a very long way. But then we have these super toxins like heavy metals and glyphosate that are classified as obesogens because they create obese human beings. And the way that this works is really sophisticated. The way that the body is designed is incredible. The number one priority for the human body is survival. It will do everything to survive. So when these super toxins enter our body, the metabolism activates a pathway called PPAR gamma, which simply takes those toxins out of the bloodstream and puts them into your fat cells because there's room there. And if there's not room, it'll increase your adipocytes, your fat cells, or create new fat cells for those toxins to live in because the solution to pollution is dilution. It's diluting these toxins. And that's how they create fat human beings, overweight, obese human beings, and they're stored there. And we start to lose weight, we start dumping toxins, and then we recirculate and the body starts burning fat because every time we burn fat, we dump these toxins and we create weight loss resistance. But Mark, there's actually a new classification of toxins I talk about in the book called diabetogens. These are toxins that actually trigger diabetes. They disrupt your pancreas beta cell function and create insulin resistance and diabetes. And these studies I'm looking at that Dr. Pompa has shared with me has been incredible. It's showing that 33% of all diabetic cases in the US are from these diabetogens. They're from toxins, not even from sugar and carbohydrates, from freaking toxins. So we have a big issue. We want to keep our detox pathways open. And I talk about how to do that in the book. Sauna, exercise, movement, coffee enemas, castor oil packs, anything you can do to keep those pathways open so we remove those toxins from our body. This is a big issue. And I pray we're going to start removing fluoride from our water. We're going to start regulating glyphosate and taking these metals out of vaccinations. It's really important because I think it's the number one cause to metabolic dysfunction.
Yeah, you know, in Calgary, where we just moved to, they just voted back in fluoride into the water.
Wow.
I know. At this point, I'm just like, I have a good friend who's a dentist. We were out a couple weeks ago and I got offered some tap water. And I said, you know, I'll drink it till they put that fluoride back in. And I forgot that he was a dentist. And he looked at me, he's like, well, you know, at the levels, it's not toxic. And I was like, buddy, it is a neurotoxin. So it is toxic by definition. And I was like, so anyways, I was looking up because I had read some stuff on it affecting mitochondrial function. And, you know, the argument of the Cochrane review on fluoride use was that there's enough fluoride in toothpaste that actually putting it in water is not actually necessary anymore. Anyway, so I sent him that and I sent him a bunch of papers on mitochondrial function and fluoride, to which he did not reply. But I think it's just so interesting that the citizens of the city did not vote to have fluoride back in. The lobbyists who influence city council were probably sitting on a boatload of it because they previously were putting it in. And I'm just like, and it's all masquerading as being done for our health. That's the bullshit part of it.
Yeah.
Just like all the things that you mentioned, glyphosate, I don't know how that one is, but people don't realize how dead our food is, how nutrient dead our soil is. And I heard Brett Weinstein say recently that we're brilliantly designed for a world that no longer exists. Mm. And you know what you're proposing is to go back to a way that we actually used to eat, you know, depending on the part of the world and et cetera. Just like sitting beside a tree is really good for you. You know, like we know that everything you're proposing is not, it makes logical sense. And yet it's just so frustrating that the people in positions of authority, perceived authority due to whatever academic standing, et cetera, where the money flows, where all the systems really love each other. Like, Ozempic is a GLP-1 agonist, right? Mm-hmm. And high fructose corn syrup is a GLP-1 antagonist, right? And I think, what's the other sugar that was put into foods in the late 70s, 80s? So now we have the solution to the thing. We just poisoned our population, you know, for 20, 30, 40 years. And now here's the solution. But the solution is not that, as you said. That's the easy way. Again, but it's not easy. Like, that's the bullshit about it. Do you have thoughts on GLP-1s?
I do. And I'm not an expert in this field, so I'm not going to give too many thoughts. Again, my premise is that the body is built to heal itself. And any medication to me is a mismatch with my premise. So I don't use it. I don't recommend it. I've seen some studies on low dose Ozempic being beneficial for brain health, and it's helped some people, of course, but a lot of people are not doing low dose. They're doing it long term, high dose. I know it's very expensive. I think it's about $1,500 a month on average, and A lot of people are doing it long-term, and there is some weight loss, but then there's muscle loss as well. And muscle is very important for insulin sensitivity and longevity. So it's not my cup of tea. It's not the approach I take. I don't use it. I haven't studied it enough to be an expert on it as well. So I don't know. I will say, I don't know if there are benefits to it for some people. I know some people that use it in my circle that love it. But for me, I don't really use it. Yeah.
Yeah, I know some people using it low dose, et cetera, talking about sort of microdosing it. I'm curious, when people are, you talked about PCOS before. I know someone who actually just got prescribed Ozempic for PCOS, but I'm curious, like, why does PCOS couple with these other things?
PCOS is an insulin resistance issue. It's high levels of insulin, and it typically happens in females, obviously, only females, obviously. So polycystic ovarian syndrome. It's a result of excess insulin. Insulin is a growth factor, so they it creates this process of PCOS. So, if they lose weight, Ozempic may help with that. It may kickstart their progress to lose weight and potentially help reverse the PCOS. But is it actually getting to the cause? If they don't change their lifestyle, then no. So, there might be a role for it in PCOS when you reference Ozempic. But I mean, I've worked with so many individuals, well, women who have PCOS, and we've never used Ozempic. We've used lifestyle changes, and it's very easy to reverse PCOS, just like it's very easy to reverse insulin resistance and type 2 diabetes because it's the same cause, high levels of insulin. Again, back to the point earlier, that's the first domino to fall. So if you lower insulin, you will reverse PCOS, prediabetes, and type 2 diabetes. And the way to do that is the way we outlined earlier in the conversation.
Wow. Okay, well, that's good to know. Yep. I'm going to have to drop that little nugget, that little clip when this comes out to my friend.
Please.
I'm curious, you're a large proponent of intermittent fasting. You talk about that as the approach to move people into that keto flex space. What do you think about people who talk about fasting not being good, especially for women?
Oh, yeah. I see that a lot. To me, that's like saying exercise is not good for women because it's too stressful. Because the reason why they say fasting for women is not good is because it's too stressful for them. That's like saying exercise is also not good because it's too stressful. So they don't understand hormesis. And I talk about hormesis in the book. Mark, are you familiar with hormesis at all? I'm just curious.
Like hermetic stress, like when you put your body under a stress? Yeah. Yep. I'm only familiar because of my education I've gotten from you.
I love it. The people who say fasting is not good for women because of stress is they don't understand hormetic stressors, as you just said. Hormesis is defined as a phenomenon. I'm giving you the Wikipedia definition. I'm giving you a better definition afterwards because the Wikipedia definition is not good. But it's defined as a phenomenon in which you apply a physiological stress to a human being and the human being adapts to the stress and it's stronger. Okay, what does that mean? That means essentially what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Stress is vital for health, longevity, fat loss, metabolism, as long as you are adapting to the stress. You stay in what's called this hermetic zone. So the perfect example of this is exercise. If you've never or haven't exercised in 10 years, and then you're like, you're inspired, it's the new year, you sign up for a gym membership, let's say it's a CrossFit membership, and you go do a 60-minute CrossFit WOD, you violated hormesis. It was too much stress for you. You're going to be sore for a week and you're going to be inflamed as a result of doing too much too soon. But if you, instead of doing CrossFit, sort of just walking, maybe doing some bodyweight exercises, you rested, recovered, you've actually stayed in your hermetic zone. You're stronger, you're healthier, you're better, right? So fasting is also a stress like exercise. It doesn't mean it's bad unless you do too much or too soon. So fasting for women is incredible. I've worked with thousands of women and I use fasting on all of them. And when you do it the right way, it sensitizes hormones, helps you burn fat, helps you lower insulin, it fixes your gut, helps with autoimmune conditions. Fasting is like nature's reset button. I love it for every human being at the right dosage for the right duration. So how do you know? Like, how do you know too much is, you're doing too much fasting, right? Well, first of all, before fasting, we want to get into a low carbohydrate diet or a keto approach. It makes fasting much more powerful and it allows your hormetic ceiling to increase. But during a fast, some things to pay attention to know if your fast is working for you or against you for both men and women are the following. How do you feel during the fast? You should feel more energized. You should have more focus, more clarity. You should feel good during your fasting window, not worse. If you feel irritable, low energy, headache, you're doing too much fasting too soon. You want to shorten your fasting window, build it back up. Fasting is like a muscle. You want to build it back up. Now, if you really want to get geeky here and do what Mark and I do, you want to look at your blood glucose and blood ketones during the fast. And I talk about this in the book. Let's say you do a 16-hour fast. During the 16-hour fast, you want to continuously check your blood glucose and blood ketones, maybe 3 times during that 16-hour. And what you want to see is glucose dropping continuously during the fast and ketones rising. That's showing your body is adapting to the stress and you're getting a good metabolic response. But if you see glucose rising and ketones dropping, the fast was too much of a stress for you. So that's probably the best way to gauge it. A third method here would be to look at your heart rate variability. And I use this Oura Ring to track that, but there's also Whoop bands and Apple Watches and Garmin devices, but anything that tracks heart rate variability, which is looking at your nervous system, and it's looking at the balance of your nervous system. We have our sympathetic nervous system, fight or flight, which fasting does activate. Then you have your parasympathetic nervous system, rest, digest, recover. A healthy nervous system goes back and forth, and your heart rate variability increases as a result. If you're doing fasting and tracking your heart rate variability and you see your average heart rate variability dropping, you're doing too much fasting. So those three metrics will help you determine if you're staying in this hormetic zone or not.
That's so interesting. I didn't know that about HRV, but it makes sense from a stress state. So fasting activates the sympathetic response.
Yeah, it activates your counter-regulatory hormones. These are hormones that run counter to insulin. It's your sympathetic tone, cortisol, adrenaline. Again, it's not bad unless you're doing excessive fasting. And for women, they do it differently than men, right? There's a point there when people say, you know, women shouldn't do fasting. That's not true, but they do it differently than men. Women who have a menstrual cycle do it differently than women who are postmenopausal, but they do it differently. And that's where you need to work with a practitioner who understands how those hormones work.
Yeah. You also talk about seed oils a lot. I have your allergy card for seed oils, which is great. I use that to, when I'm at a restaurant, it's actually like, cause you know, if you're that guy and you're like, hey, can you please cook my stuff with no seed oils? And they're like, ah, here's that fucking guy who's making me have to clean the canola oil off the everything. But when I use that card, it's actually received with a lot of respect and it makes it. So the card has the conversation for me.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah, it's been really helpful. So why do you have such a perceivably great disdain for seed oils?
Seed oils are kind of like an environmental toxin. 80% of our food supply in the United States have these seed oils. They're also called vegetable oils, omega-6 fats. They're highly inflammatory. And the reason why I have this disdain and whatever you want to put it for seed oils is because of the research on it. These fats are as inflammatory, probably more inflammatory than cigarettes and even processed sugar. And the reason why is because they stay in your body for a very long time. When you consume them, they go into your cell membranes, your fat cells, your mitochondrial membranes, and they're there for years. The half-life is 680 days. That's the half-life, Mark. So if you remove them today, 2 years
that's
later.
That's really long. That's
half
4 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
680 days
is two, but the half-life means
but the full life double. The full life is, but it's actually longer than that. The full life is closer than 6 to 7 years to get them fully removed.
My God.
And what the reason why they're mitochondrial and they're mitochondrial poison. That's the reason why they're so inflammatory. And you're going to like this. I don't think you know this because it's new. It's a new study I put in the book. A recent study from this researcher, Dr. Martin Grudfeld, he did a study where he was looking at French fries that were fried in vegetable oil. And he was looking at the aldehyde contents produced from the French fries. So aldehydes are what's called carcinogenic. They're cancer causing. When you smoke cigarettes, it produces aldehydes, which is why cigarette smoking is linked to cancer. So they looked at the aldehyde content from 5 ounces of French fries, which is about 25 French fries. And the study showed...
So easy to eat.
Yeah, so easy. I've had numerous 5 ounce French fries. The study showed that a 5 ounce serving of French fries has as much aldehyde content as 25 tobacco cigarettes. Meaning, one French fry from McDonald's, for example, is equivalent to one tobacco cigarette smoked, right? So if you've never smoked cigarettes in your life, about how many French fries you've had cooked in vegetable oil. Add that up. That's how many cigarettes you've smoked in terms of aldehyde content produced. So yes, seed oils are bad. They're bad news. Your body doesn't know what to do with it. Again, they're toxins. They go into your fat cells. So we want to avoid them. We want the good old saturated fats. Butter,
yeah,
all the good stuff. Tallow, that's the stuff we want.
If you're listening to this podcast and you're thinking, I want to build those skills. I want to learn how to create epic love. I want to heal from a breakup. I want to heal my nervous system as I'm in the dating process so I can choose the most aligned partner to create a future with. Well, I have the perfect opportunity for you. Because you're listening to the Create the Love podcast, you get to bypass the waiting list for the Create the Love community. You can go to createthelove.com/yes and get started with whichever course is most applicable to your life and the skill set you want to develop. And here's one thing I know for certain is that great love can't wait. You have to get started right away. Your healing can't wait. So go register now at createthelove.com/yes and get started right away. The message that is sent, though, it's so interesting. Like during the campaign for the president, everything was getting politicized, you know, as happens. But one thing I thought was so fucking dumb, I don't pardon my language, but one thing was this idea that why is the right obsessed with seed oils? And I was like, first, I think I was in Politico or something, which that now makes sense due to their funding, but or maybe it was The Atlantic. The Atlantic loves shit like this. But I remember thinking like, why are you trying to, like, why not just tell the truth? They actually promote seed oils to lower LDL, don't they? Like heart healthy oils.
Yeah. And yeah, they do. there's a lot of misconception around it. Yeah. Lower LDL, but that's not even, you don't even necessarily want to lower LDL. It's really about the particles of the LDL, which is a different conversation we could get into if you want. But yeah, their arguments are very weak. The American Heart Association has their stamp of approval on these vegetable oils. And you know that is the case because when you go to the shopping center, the grocery store, canola oil has that American Heart Healthy stamp of approval. And why? Like, that's the American Heart Association. Well, they're in bed with Big Pharma, Big Gov, and these pharmaceutical companies. And it's Dr. Kay Shanahan called the American Heart Association the biggest fake news organization in America. They fund a lot of these studies. It dupes a lot of people, and it's not a conservative thing. This is a human thing. Our cells do not see
wings.
Yeah, our cells don't see color. It doesn't see red. It doesn't see blue. It sees health, right? It's just so bogus. When I saw that, I was like, really? This is the angle you guys are taking? Like, really? So stupid, man.
Well, just the level, then it becomes political, and then it becomes divisive. And then you're like, wait, now I can't talk about that because I'm considered a right-wing extremist because I don't like seed oils and inflammation. It does seem like it's frustrating. It's frustrating because even the conversation, you know, you mentioned about LDL, is there's so much misconception. Like, unless you actually dive deeper into that, which we did cover on the last episode we did, so I'll make sure I link that through.
And you had Dr. Philip Bovadia as well, who's brilliant. Yeah.
Yeah, and it was like, if you don't go beyond the surface, you will be convinced, like I did when I called you, I'm going to die from a heart attack. And you were like, whoa, like, let's take a look. And with the diet changes through your consultation, I changed my particle size of the LDL and completely changed that profile, which was really amazing. And now I'm really working on through the sprints, raising my HDL.
Yeah.
So I'm really excited to see what's possible. But man, again, you know, it's like looking at this conversation about seed oils. Seed oils are Also, didn't McDonald's used to have tallow in their fryer and they changed it over to...
Yeah, they used to use beef tallow in their fries. Yeah.
Damn, that would have been good. Like, why?
You know, I'm starting to see a trend, though. This is very exciting, right? Steak and Shake now said they're going to use beef tallow. Other restaurants are going to follow suit. But I'm also very cautious as well, because they could say we're using beef tallow and also cut it with a seed oil or cut it with other chemicals. So you want to make sure if a restaurant, especially these commercial restaurants, are saying they're using beef tallow, ask them if it's 100% beef tallow. Mm. Even if it's not grass-fed, that's fine, but is it 100% beef tallow? Because there could be some wiggle room. And I bet you these companies are going to hop on this no seed oil train and use beef tallow, but still find a way to manipulate it. So make sure they don't take advantage of you.
Yeah. So when you're looking at, you were talking about the problems. We got insulin, environmental toxins, seed oils. What else? Is there anything else we're missing that is really a large contributor to this metabolic dysfunction?
Yeah. You know, I also talk about, you know, sleep, lack of quality sleep and stress. But I think I want to actually navigate towards chapter 10 because of I know you and I know your platform. And I say this, what I'm about to say is not to impress you, Mark, or anybody on here, but it's to make an impression that I spent the most time on chapter 10. And I really believe that it's the greatest chapter ever written inside of a book. And I say that.
Hey-o. I love that.
I say that with confidence because it was my favorite chapter and I did an extraordinary amount of research. So here's the title of the chapter. You're going to like this: How Your Thoughts Influence Your Metabolism and Longevity. Mm-hmm. And it's all about your thoughts, your self-image, the concept of psycho-cybernetics, and the placebo effect, the nocebo effect. So I'd love to shift into chapter 10.
Let's freaking do it, man. Yeah. I love it.
So I start the chapter out with a story to illustrate how powerful your thoughts can be towards either health or disease or death. And the chapter starts off with this story from the 1960s. And this story I got from Bob Proctor, who referenced it from a newspaper. And it's about this gentleman who worked on a railroad station, on a railroad track. And he worked inside a refrigerator cart inside of a train. And he was working late one evening. He didn't realize it was getting late. All of his coworkers had clocked out. And he actually got locked, trapped inside of the refrigerator cart. So around 11 p.m. at night, this guy's banging on the door. Nobody's around. He's locked in there. And he's starting to panic, realizing that nobody's going to be there until the next morning. So he started to write on the wall, kind of document his journey throughout the night. And around midnight, he wrote the words, "I'm stuck in here. Nobody's going to come around for another several hours. I'm freezing. I don't know how I'm going to survive tonight." 1 a.m., still freezing. Can't seem to get myself warm, keep myself warm. I keep looking at the temperature apparatus. I keep seeing it drop. Around 3 a.m., freezing. I'm going to die out here. I can barely hold on. 7 a.m. rolls around. His coworkers clock in. They open up that refrigerator cart. And they see this man dead, hypothermia. He froze to death. What was interesting is that the temperature apparatus this guy was looking at had been malfunctioning for days, and the temperature never dropped below 55 degrees Fahrenheit. His thoughts created death. And I make the point that if your thoughts can do that, do you think your thoughts could also heal your body? And the answer is you're damn right. So that is what's called the nocebo effect, where your thoughts work against you, your beliefs work against you. You could turn that into the placebo effect. And we've all heard about the placebo effect. In the book, I talk about the origins of the placebo effect that actually originated during World War II. There was a doctor named Dr. Henry Beecher, and he was working with the United States military. And during a German bombardment, he had all these soldiers coming into his medical tent with bullet wounds, legs blown off. They needed amputation. So he was administering morphine to stabilize these soldiers, to calm them down long enough for the ambulance to pick them up, transfer them to the hospital, and perform surgery and save their life. But they ended up running out of morphine. And one of the nurses didn't know what to do. So she panicked and she actually just grabbed saline solution, salt water, put it into the needle, told Dr. Beecher, "I'm giving you morphine." So he had the belief he had morphine in his hands. He would tell the soldier, I'm giving you morphine. You're going to stabilize in a matter of seconds. He would inject them with salt water and they survived from salt water. When the war ended, they researched, Harvard did, what happened in this medical tent. How did they survive with salt water? And that's where the placebo effect originated. That's where they started using studies with the placebo control, right? So this is really powerful because we can direct. Isn't it so fascinating, Mark?
Yeah.
It's so cool because we could direct our thoughts towards healing or towards symptoms and disease. And we have 60,000 thoughts a day. And you are so masterful about being aware of your thoughts and teaching people how to become aware of their thoughts. And I love your work on this. So you're going to love this chapter. 60,000 thoughts a day. And Dr. Bruce Lipton has proven your thoughts, and you've had him on the podcast, correct?
Yeah.
Your thoughts are a frequency that communicate with your DNA to produce a protein. If it's a hateful thought, angry thought, resentful thought, bitter thought, that protein is inflammatory. It shortens your telomeres, damages your DNA, shortens your lifespan. However, if it's a loving thought, grateful thought, abundant thought, same signal sent, now it's an anti-inflammatory protein, protects your telomeres, extends your lifespan. So if we have 60,000 thoughts a day, we have 60,000 opportunities to put the body in a healing state. And I think that's the greatest biohack in the world because we have control over that. Well, we don't have control over our thoughts, but we could manipulate them in certain ways. We could change our environment to change our thoughts. And I talk about the environmental piece. So the thoughts are so important. I think it's missed by almost everybody in the health space. That's why I decided to put it in the book. And one of the key pieces in that chapter is this concept of self-image. I got the research from Maxwell Maltz, who wrote the book Psycho-Cybernetics. Have you read that, Mark?
No, but I know of it. Is it good?
Yeah, it's an old book from the 1960s. Yeah. And essentially, he called it the greatest physiological discovery of his time. And that was this concept of self-image, the way we view ourselves. And I've seen so many times people make a conscious decision to change their diet, change their lifestyle. They try to lose weight. But subconsciously, their self-image is that of an obese person, an overweight person, or they identify with their autoimmune disease, their cancer, their diagnosis. So they start to make progress, and then they go back to where they were because their self-image is of that person, their old ways. And you cannot outperform the self-image. So the book talks about that in respect to weight loss. When somebody makes a conscious decision to go on a plan to lose weight, a diet plan or whatever it is, they lose 5 pounds in 1 month. They gain it all back the next month. 5 pounds off the next month, they gain it back. And it's just yo-yo dieting because they never change the self-image. They have a self-image of an overweight person, and they'll continue to course correct to match that self-image. It's like an airplane that takes off and sets autopilot. It hits turbulence. It hits different things that knock it out of its GPS range or its target, and then it course corrects to get to its destination. We do the same thing with our self-image. We course correct to match the self-image. So in the book, I talk about where that self-image is, and it's deep inside of our paradigms, our subconscious mind. And we need to replace that old idea with the new idea, the new image. And there's only two ways I've discovered, and I'm curious to see if you've seen different ways to change it. The first way is an emotional impact, like a loss of a loved one, a cancer diagnosis, a health scare. That usually changes the way you think, changes your self-image, changes your paradigm. Now, ideally, that's not the optimal route because it's unpredictable, and 9 times out of 10, it's a negative experience. Mm-hmm. The second way, which is the preferred way that I talk about in the book, is the constant spaced repetition of that new idea where you imprint it over and over and over, where it replaces that old idea in the subconscious mind. And you do this with an affirmation. Do this all the time with affirmations. I write it down, and I actually have an affirmation in the book that I give the readers to write down and imprint it over and over and over, especially in the morning and before bed, but throughout the day, over and over and over until you replace the old self-image with this new identity. And once you do that, you become unstoppable. You don't course correct anymore. You continue to make progress. And I think this is such a missing piece in the health space that I don't see anybody else talk about. And credit goes to Bob Proctor because I learned all about this from him. But Mark, I shared a lot there, and I'm curious to hear your thoughts because this is definitely your realm, and I want to hear your thoughts on what I just shared.
Well, all of it makes so much sense. Like when you look at the physiological impact of inflammatory relationships, it's a direct impact on the body. You look at, you know, it makes sense that if you're in conflict with someone outside, you know, you're in relationship with, it's leaving you in a parasympathetic or in a sympathetic state. So you're activated all the time. If you're activated, you're not healing. You're dumping glucose in the body in order to get into fight, flight, freeze, fawn. And so mobilize or even immobilize. But either way, you're like putting and I actually think a lot about this, Ben. I've been thinking about this a lot, that the body actually can't differentiate a notification of a troll or a comment from a tiger. And so actually, I think that I have this whole theory that, which is now being shared in this moment, that a slow killer of influencers and people on social media is actually the notifications, the emails, the constant dumping of glucose, which makes sense because I got an email that was about something legal and I was wearing a CGM. This was like 3 years ago and my blood went to like 140 or something, 150. Wow. And then I was taking my in-laws' horses out to feed them. And one of them started like bucking and shit. I'm not qualified for a bucking horse, like started jumping, wanted food. It was pulling me. I was like, I've watched Yellowstone, but it did not prepare me for this. But I then had this like awareness because I was off social media. I had left and I was like, oh,
wow.
Oh, wow. I haven't been around that level of stress. It's the horse is created, but I'm not around that type of stuff because I haven't been on social media. So I started to really see how do we build in the layers to protect us from that. So all that to come back to think about how much thoughts are impacted by social media, by algorithms, by comments, by everything. And when you look at the adverse childhood experiences study, people who have higher levels of cumulative stress have much higher levels of autoimmune diseases. So,
and cancer.
Yeah, and cancer. So you kind of go, well, if the only thing we were to do, like a couple things, remove the inflammatory nature of our foods and really take responsibility for the inflammatory nature of our thoughts. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure, like, who wouldn't heal under that state. So and if you were to only do thoughts, who knows, but you might as well do food while you're at it. But if you were only to do thoughts, you know, it will probably insulate you over time from the cumulative effect of things like diet. What do you think?
100%. And, you know, when you change your nutrition and inflammatory foods, it helps you have better thoughts because you reduce it goes hand in hand. So yeah, powerful. Remove inflammatory food and inflammatory thoughts and oof, you're gonna take off like a rocket. It's so powerful.
Abundance, man. You would start to make more money. You'd start to feel better. You'd have a six pack, you know, it's like everything changes. I'm curious, like I'm so happy that you wrote that chapter and that you're so proud of it as you should be. Because I think it's not pointed to enough that if you were to just do the work of resolving that, you would be so much more healthy and you'd be called to action. Because then, as you know, as we sort of started with, you then wouldn't be able to be in relationship with abusive people, toxic people. And I think a lot of like, if we eat toxic foods, I really believe we're more likely to not stand against toxic relationships. Us being toxic too in that context.
Yeah, powerful. I agree 100%. 100%. One of the other things that I talk about in the book, chapter 10 as well, is the power of purpose, the longevity benefits of having purpose and having something to work towards. And I reference like studies that show those people who retire have a shorter lifespan after they retire because they don't have any goals, they don't have any purpose. Yeah, it's very fascinating. And I think that when we think about obesity, in the context of obesity, a lot of people in the health space say we have these obesity rates because of what people are eating. And that may be true. We're eating a lot of inflammatory foods, yeah. Made the case for that.
Chemical. Certainly a part of it.
Yeah, certainly part of it. But I think the majority of the reason why we have obesity is not necessarily because of what people are eating, but because of what is eating people. Mm-hmm. They're feeling a void. They're unhappy. They're not living a life on purpose with their purpose. They don't even know what their purpose is. So there's a quote in the book that's one of my favorite quotes from Robert Heinlein, which is relevant to what I'm sharing here. And he said, "In absence of clearly defined goals, we become strangely loyal to performing daily trivia until ultimately we become enslaved by it." Mm. All right, let's unpack that real quick because it's a really powerful quote. I want your audience to really get it. In the absence of clearly defined goals, meaning you don't know what's important, you don't have any values, or if you do, you're not living in congruent with that, you become strangely loyal to performing daily trivia. Daily trivia, food addiction, porn addiction, alcohol addiction, toxic social relationship, media. Yeah. Social media. I dealt with a lot of those.
Same. I love all those things.
Yeah. They're feel good, instant gratification, right? But they're a result of lack of purpose, lack of goals. They're a void, in my opinion, that we're filling for an immediate hit because we feel so numb. But when we get clear on those goals and we find out what lights us up and we live on purpose with the purpose, those addictive behaviors become a superpower because we put a lot of energy into our addictions, don't we, Mark? A lot of energy. Yeah. And if you could do that, and I just said this on stage the other day at a keynote in Miami, and it actually landed well with the audience. And I was happy to hear that. I'm going to say it now. Sometimes it doesn't land well, but I said, if you have an addiction or if you've had an addiction, congratulations. That can be a superpower because when you find out what you love to do and transfer that energy you're putting into your addictions to what you love to do, you are going to be unstoppable. That's what I did. Like Amen. Yeah, 100%. So congratulations if you are addicted right now. Find out what you love to do, transfer that energy, and watch what happens to your life. It's just incredible.
Yeah, I think not being in integrity with our values and our purpose actually is what creates the doorway for the addiction. Mm-hmm. You know, and yep. You know, there's that saying that the opposite of addiction is connection. And so it's like connection to self, connection to purpose, right? It's like connection to passion, connection. When I finally stepped into teaching relationships, that's when I quit the things that were bad for me. I began the journey because I started to realize that being in my heart and being in my purpose, I didn't want to do anything that jeopardized that because it was too important to me. And I think we all need to find something that's more important to us than our addictions and our bullshit and our excuses. And, you know, there's that quote that's gone pretty viral. That is, if they wanted to, they would. And there's been a lot of pushback on it. Like, oh, no, that's not true. You got to take into context, trauma, etc. I get it. But at the end of the day, the explicit nature of those words and expression is true. Like, if I really wanted to, I would. Have you ever seen the meme that went viral years ago that it said, try replacing I don't have time with it's not a priority.
Yeah, it's the truth.
And it kicks you right in the soul nuts because you're like, shit, that's true. Like there's a truth to that. And if I can just acknowledge that, then I'm like, okay, it's not a priority. Okay, then let's just be honest. You talk about a few, I know I don't want to like go take too much of your time. You talk about some biohacks to achieve next level health. So that's a chapter 11. So I'm just curious, like, as a lover of a good biohack, what are just like, give me some grains of it. Grains, but.
Biohacking, right? It's becoming more popular and I love it. It's a great, great space. Again, it needs to be applied in the context of hormesis, like we spoke about earlier, because all biohacks are stressors. They are. So you don't want to do too much too soon. You want to adapt to it and adjust. But in the chapter, I talk about my favorite paid biohacks and my favorite free biohacks. So some of the free ones out there, which can be free or paid, but a cold plunge. I know you have a plunge. I have a plunge. Plunge.com is what we have.
Ryan, the best.
Yeah, man. Ryan, we appreciate you. And you could share your coupon code with your audience down below in the notes. So plunging is terrific because a lot of great things happen when you're in a plunge, but you want to go low and slow. You don't want to do too much too soon. But when you enter a cold body of water, and it could be a plunge or it could be a cold shower if it gets cold enough or just a cold lake. But when you start to shiver, that's where the benefits come. It needs to be cold enough to shiver. Usually that's 59 degrees Fahrenheit or less. Some people need it colder. But when you start to shiver like that, what happens in your body is really incredible. You create vasoconstriction where your arteries actually narrow slightly. And it might sound like a bad thing, but it actually creates this vascular massage where blood flow goes away from your extremities. It activates something called Hunter's reflex. And all that blood flow is delivered to your internal organs. And it starts to just give you this vascular massage. Mm. And then you activate cold shock proteins where now your mitochondria start to go through this mitochondrial biogenesis, which simply means the creation of new mitochondria. So you have white fat, which is the visceral fat, the belly fat, the organ fat, which now starts to turn beige and then brown. It's a browning effect of this fat, which is the good fat. Brown fat is the good active fat that has a lot of mitochondria, which raises your metabolic rate, helps you burn more fat. So you get that effect as well. And then when you get out of the cold plunge, that blood flow is now shunted back to your extremities and it creates vasodilation. So it's an incredible vascular massage helps with dopamine, immune system health, testosterone. It's like taking a shot of coffee, right? When you get out of that cold plunge, you just feel so like
it's insane.
Incredible. It's so epinephrine, noradrenaline, all these amazing chemicals are activated. You feel incredible, but there's a right way to do it. In the book, I talk about why we don't want a cold plunge after a workout, for example. We want a cold plunge if we are going to do it around a workout before the workout. You want to cool down to warm up, is what I call it. Because when you work out, you create an inflammatory response, which is good. Your body adapts to it and you get stronger. But when you go into a cold plunge after a workout, you blunt the body's natural ability to deal with that workout, and it could prevent you from getting the maximum benefit from that workout. So you don't want a cold plunge after a workout. You want to do it before. And you know, this might be interesting for you, Mark, as you plunge. I found a study that showed cold plunging in the morning is far superior for both men and women than cold plunging later in the day in the evening. It showed better effects with the brown fat in the morning, better effects on our lipid profiles like triglyceride, HDL in the morning
interesting.
Versus later. So, and the study concluded that it's our circadian rhythm is designed to have this cold exposure earlier in the day.
That makes sense.
Later in the day. So it's really fascinating.
Do you find, too, like when you're wearing a CGM that you notice your glucose spike a little bit from the cold and then will it have a more significant drop through the day from the beginning?
You know, I actually have not ever worn it inside of a cold plunge. So
I noticed a little spike.
Yeah, that would make
but
sense.
I haven't tracked, like I've built so much more knowledge than last. My cold plunge is not at the house that I'm currently at because we moved back to Calgary. So it's living in Idaho, which is great for the cold plunge. My friend is using it. So he's living the great life, but I'm just like, I'm going to get another one. Yeah, I'm just waiting for our house to be renovated. Cause I want to get the all in. The all in is sexy.
Yeah, sick.
Oh, it's so sexy. I'm just like, I never knew I could think of a cold plunge as being hot, but that's a hot cold plunge.
Yeah. Sick.
Yeah. So cold plunging, what else?
The next one is sauna. Sauna is actually probably my favorite one.
I love it.
This is a paid biohack, of course, but I also have an infrared sauna here in my backyard with the cold plunge. And sauna does the opposite of cold plunge. It activates heat shock proteins, but it vasodilates your bloodstream, which is really important because it opens up your arteries, which allows oxygen and blood flow to deliver to tissues more effectively. It boosts nitric oxide, which is a very important gaseous molecule for mitochondrial health and longevity. So it increases nitric oxide, which of course lowers high blood pressure. It also helps with fat loss, recovering from workouts. So you can actually do a sauna after a workout, before a workout, anytime. It's terrific for you. There's of course infrared sauna, dry sauna, steam sauna. All of them are great. You just want to sweat. And I forgot to mention this, Mark. On the cold plunge, the studies show getting 11 minutes total per week is the sweet spot for all these benefits. 11 minutes total under 59 degrees Fahrenheit. For the sauna, it's around about an hour and a half total per week. And you can do more if you want, but about an hour and a half. And the studies on the sauna are incredible.
They're insane, man.
As it relates to like all cause mortality and heart disease, it's like a dramatic reduction with continuous sauna usage. It's amazing.
Yeah, we just got the Sauna Space sauna. Do you know that one?
I love Sauna Space and Brian. Oh, yeah, he's terrific.
Oh, the like nerding out because I interviewed him for the podcast because I listened to him on Luke Stories podcast and I was like, oh my God, this is insane. So we got the one that has the EMF shield around
it. Yeah, the Faraday cage. Yeah.
Dude, I'm like getting into this thing and my body just goes into like there's no radio waves at all. Yeah, it's just sick. Insane. I'm just like a super fan. So what are cold plunging, you could do cold showers. So that's free.
Or
what
lake.
Other, what's like a cheap, another cheap biohack? And then we'll leave them with one more super biohack. What do you got?
Okay. Grounding, earthing, getting outside and putting your feet on Mother Nature. It's like taking ibuprofen without all the side effects of ibuprofen. It's anti-inflammatory. It doesn't beat up your liver like a medication would. But yeah, it's great because the Earth is struck by lightning millions of times on a continuous basis, and it creates this electrical charge. And what happens is when we're around all these electronics, like we are, this beautiful technology we have here to connect us from different parts of the world, we have all these EMFs, and it creates inflammation in our body. And we're blocking ourselves from the conductive nature of the Earth. We wear rubber soles, rubber shoes, and we're never really just grounding, which recharges us and lowers inflammation, thins the blood, lowers blood pressure, great for pain and inflammation when you ground. So simply just taking your shoes off and walking barefoot on either grass, dirt, or sand, amazing. It's like taking a handful of antioxidants. My dog has recently diagnosed with lymphoma. And we're doing, thank you, bro. And we're doing a lot of things for him. He's 11, and we have him on a lot of protocols right now, and I'm determined to make sure we control this. But one of the things I'm doing is I'm having him ground every day, 30 minutes, 60 minutes to help with inflammation. I'm doing other things for him as well. But grounding is profound. There's amazing stories about just grounding and what it did to heal people. So it's free. And you could take a phone call and work at the same time, or you could just be out in nature. But just putting your feet on the earth, we're blocking ourselves with rubber soles and being inside all day. So go outside and ground. Even if you hug a tree, yes, a tree hugger, you get grounding benefits as well. So that's an amazing free biohack for you.
Yeah, and you can now buy grounding shoes, right? Where they're like running shoes that have...
Yeah, they're 100% leather. Yep. And then you could also get grounding sheets and grounding mats as well. Just make sure you set it up the right way, because sometimes you could have like a grounding sheet and mat and put it into your outlet, and it has dirty electricity, and you're actually getting the opposite effect. So they usually come, these grounding mats and sheets, with a little device that tests your outlet to make sure it's a clean source.
Oh, that's awesome. Okay. Well, for everyone listening, watching, we'll put all the links to all the things in the show notes. We got discount codes for all the things, because you're going to want to nerd out on some of this. Yeah. Ben, your book, where can people get it?
Yeah. Well, first of all, thanks for having me back, dude, Mark. I love and appreciate you, bro. I could
nerd out on this stuff all day.
Yeah, we could talk for hours, and I'm sure we will offline. But thank you for having me back. It's been such a great conversation. You're a great host, and I love your work. The book is out May 13th. However, you could pre-order it today over at metabolicfreedombook.com. And if you do order it on that website, you are going to get a free course I designed on the metabolism with 12 lessons, along with exclusive interviews from Dr. Daniel Pompa, Gary Brecka, Dr. Jason Fung, Megan Ramos, and Cynthia Thurlow. So these are interviews you cannot find anywhere else. You can get all that for free when you go to metabolicfreedombook.com. The book is available on hardcover, Kindle, and on Audible. I actually just finished up the Audible narration 2 days ago. Amazing. So any way you like to get your book, it's available. And I'd love for you to get the book if this conversation resonated with you over at metabolicfreedombook.com.
Perfect. We'll put all the links to all your socials, brother. So appreciate you. Thanks for the work you do. And thank you so much for personally helping me in my journey. And I just feel so much better to think it was like a year and a half that we had that conversation and everything has changed. So I really appreciate you.
It's an honor. Appreciate you, brother.
Thanks, buddy.